heard from a lot of you after the episode I did a few weeks back with Eric Berger that you really liked that format where I bring on a special guest and talk with them about the topics of the day, whatever else is on their radar. So we've got another special guest here with us today. We've got Rand Simberg, a recovering aerospace engineer, as he likes to say, and a consultant covering all things space, be it technology or policy or strategy, you name it. He's got some opinions that you're going to want to hear. He's also the author of a book called Safe is Not an Option, Overcoming the Futile Obsession with Getting Everyone Back Alive That is Killing Our Expansion into Space. It's a great read. I recommend checking it out, specifically in light of some of the things that we'll be talking about today, some of the things that are going on in the industry lately. But before we get talking to Rand, I want to real quick say thank you to all of the supporters of Main Engine Cutoff over on Patreon. There's 62 people over on Patreon supporting this show week in and week out, and this particular episode is brought to you by 12 executive producers: Pat, Matt, George, Brad, Ryan, Laszlo, Jameson, Guinevere, and 4 anonymous executive producers, along with 50 other supporters. They make this show possible week in and week out, and I'm hugely thankful for their support. So if you want to help support the show, head over to patreon.com/miko and donate as little as $1 a month. You'll get access to some extra content from time to time, and you'll get to hear about upcoming interviews like this one with Rand today and be able to chip in some ideas or topics for that show. Real quick reminder up front too, if you head over to mainenginecutoff.com, you can get the show notes for this show. I've got links to all of Rand's stuff over there, his website, his Twitter accounts, and a link to his book as well. So head over there and check out some of those links while you listen to the conversation with Rand. So with that said, let's get into it with Mr. Rand Simberg. Thank you so much for coming on the show. I'm excited to have you here today to talk about this list of things in front of us.
Glad to be here.
We'll start with the Space Tech Expo, since that's where you spent the majority of the week. What was 3 days or so out in the... Where was it at? I don't even know where it was.
It was in Pasadena at the Convention Center.
And that was most of the week, so you spent a lot of time there. I was following your Twitter feed as you went, but were there anything going on there that you thought was really interesting? Any trends you noticed? Any specific announcements or you know, topics that they covered that you found really interesting?
Well, I found the Wednesday sessions very interesting. It's actually almost like two separate events, but they're conjoined, and one of them is an actual the Space Tech Expo itself is a trade show, basically, and there were a lot of vendors. And in the past, the show's had people have shown up, like, you know, Orbital ATK a few years ago. They were actually pushing the Liberty rocket at the show, and they had a big booth, and ULA has been there, I think, in the past. And the very first one, X-Core, was kind of the star of the show, and they actually had a mock-up of the Lynx. But this year, I've noticed it's both grown in terms of the number of exhibitors, but it's not the major primes anymore. Now it's second and third tier people, you know, who are looking for customers. People, you know, with 3D printing and guidance and control and electronics and flexible electronics and a lot of the stuff that a lot of these coming space companies are going to need. And it's not clear to me how many of them. I talked to a few of them. Obviously they want to sell to anybody, but I don't know if they're figuring out how do they market to the new space people who don't have the kind of budgets that traditionally the big irons had or not. So there was the trade show aspect, and I wandered around there for a while. But in conjunction with it is they call the Space Tech Conference, and that was a single track event which was mostly, you know, a few speakers but a lot of panels. And on Wednesday, Dave Barnhart, former DARPA, now a professor at USC, also an entrepreneur, he has a company that's called Arcusys that's actually, you know, selling some of the technology that was developed when he was at DARPA. He basically was the chair for the whole day, and so he put together several very interesting sessions. And the main overall theme was in space servicing, and that encompasses a lot more than you might think. It's not just going out servicing satellites, and it includes refueling, it includes assembly, almost anything you can imagine, all the kinds of things that we've been thinking about for decades that we would do in space if we could afford to get there. And so we're on the verge of being able to afford to get there thanks to the new competition to drive down the cost of launch between Elon and Jeff Bezos, and maybe ULA as well, though they're operating under more financial constraints, financial and political. But basically, it seems to be that the launch problem is getting solved. So now people are thinking about, okay, now that we can afford to get there, what kind of things can we do? And Made in Space had a presentation.
They're doing like an all-out blitz lately. One of their people appeared on Capitol Hill at some hearing, and I've heard them on, I don't know, a few other podcasts they've sent people out to. They seem to be doing a lot in the last month or two alone. I don't know, was that tied to anything specifically, or is that just them, you know, maturing their technology and now wanting to talk about it more than they have been in the past?
Well, I think it's a combination of that and the fact that things are going on. They've got some interesting things happening. And that was, in both cases, both in Pasadena and on the Hill, that was Andrew Rush, the CEO. But I guess I was kind of surprised at how much is going on. That's why it was so interesting to me, because it wasn't just Made in Space and Firmamentum, who I always think of those two as the space assembly people, is Made in Space and Firmamentum, which is a division of Tethers Unlimited. Rob Hoyt didn't even show up. So Firmamentum wasn't represented on this panel, yet there were several presentations on what's going on, and it's not just kind of the startups. It's people like McDonnell Detweiler and SSL, which is the same thing because MDA bought SSL, Space Systems Loral, a few years ago. They're proposing to do in space assembly, and Orbital ATK is proposing to do in space assembly, and interestingly, something I discovered yesterday, which is the Arkonaut robotic space assembler that Made in Space is proposing, is actually being contracted to Northrop Grumman. So everybody's kind of getting into this, but the prevailing theme was, and well, even Airbus is proposing space assembly. So the theme is we're the age of launching a single mission on a single rocket is coming to an end, and that's the age we've been in since the 1957, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And also, if you notice the difference in the trends that you were talking about in the early days of Space Tech Expo, which was all how do we make launch cheaper, that stuff's faded away, and now we're, you know, faced with cheaper launch coming online. Now we're getting this interesting stuff. Here's what we can do now that we can get to space, and we don't have to, you know, figure out some way to gather up this many millions of dollars in the past. You know, now they can do it on these smaller budgets and actually operate in space.
Right, and that was a point that I think Andrew Rush made for Made in Space, is that, you know, we're getting to a point, we've always said this was going to happen, but it was always theoretical, that when cost of launch comes down, cost of satellites come down as well. For a number of reasons that we can go into if we need to, but the thing is that the thing that's been driving the high cost of satellites is the high cost of launch, because you have when launch is so high, the satellite has to be very lightweight. When you try to get weight out of the satellite, you increase the cost. When you try to get weight out of the satellite, you lose some margin, and so now you have to spend even more money to try to figure out ways to get the reliability back into it.
Yeah, you can only pay for one launch, so you got to make sure that thing works, rather than, you know,
right,
peppering an elliptical orbit like Planet does to image the Earth. You spend a bunch of money on four satellites maybe, but now they're
right,
just sending up, you know, 100 at a time to image the entire Earth.
Yeah. And I guess another point that Andrew made was that, which again we've known for years, but most people don't understand, was that in the days of CubeSats, it's not true anymore. But every, in general, traditionally, every satellite launch was way over designed for its orbital needs, its orbital functional requirements, because it has to go through the launch environment. It has to handle high G's. Has to take all the vibration, so there's a lot of over design in the structure of a satellite just so it can survive the launch. And once you start assembling things in space, that all goes away. Now you can build much more efficient structures up there that don't need to handle multiple G's. They live in free fall. So the general message, and this was not just from Made in Space, but it was from Airbus, and it was from SSL, and it was from Orbital ATK. Yeah, everybody's saying, look, the age of assembly is upon us, and it's going to just completely changed the world. You know, now it's basically going to be, we're going to launch stuff, materials into space, and then we're going to build stuff in space. That's the future. And it's not our future, it's the near future. And the elephant in the room that was not discussed, and there was no reason for them to discuss it, because there was no reason to want to piss NASA off, was that this completely obviates the need for SLS. There's really no, you know, this is how you defeat, I don't remember, somewhere, some recent conference, somebody was talking about the tyranny of the fairing. You know, why? And people say, well, we need 10-meter fairings or whatever. You know, if you're actually assembling things in orbit, no, you don't. But the one question that I asked from the audience in the context of all this, because it wasn't really discussed, was, okay, guys, so we see we can build trusses, we can build panels, we can do all kinds of structure, but can we do pressure vessels? Have you thought about how you do large pressure vessels? Because that's the thing.
That's the limiting factor right now.
Yeah, that's to if we, and in fact, you know, even for optics, we don't have the tyranny of the fairing anymore, because now they're coming out with these concepts for actually, you know, constructing and design and tweaking, you know, large, you know, collectors on orbit. So even that doesn't require this. And I suspect that Webb, you know, hopefully it will succeed given how much money we're spending on it. But I think that was the first and probably last origami satellite. I think in the future they're not going to try for how do we unfold stuff, because that's what they've been doing that for decades. You know, how do we make something big that fits in the fairing? And it's always been, as with Galileo, we had the failure of the high gain antenna. Mm-hmm. You know, because it got shipped back and forth across the country because they didn't know which launch vehicle was going to go up so many times. It lost the graphite lubricant on it, so that when it deployed at Jupiter, it didn't fully deploy. And then a nice side effect of that was they came up with all kinds of new data compression algorithms. Yeah, so they ended up getting almost as much back as they expected, even though they didn't had much lower bandwidth. But things like that, we're not going to figure out clever ways of getting things to fold up inside the fairing and then unfurl it when we get into space. We're just going to get up into space, and in this case, the future would be, you know, instead of sending it all the way out to L2, Earth Sun L2, not Earth Moon, you know, millions of miles away, and then hoping that it opens correctly, which is basically the plan for Webb. It's going to be, we send stuff into space, we build stuff in space, we check it out in low Earth orbit, and then we send it on its way, maybe with a low thrust system.
So was there any interesting answer to the pressure vessel question?
No, none of them had been thinking about it, except maybe Andrew.
Interesting.
And that's one reason I was kind of disappointed that Firmamentum hadn't shown up, because I think they have been thinking about that. So I guess that's a coming attraction. Okay, how are they going to do pressure vessels, both for things like propellant tanks, for liquids, and for, you know, something that can hold 14.7 psi of atmosphere so people can breathe?
The other interesting thing that kind of goes along with what you're saying, where, you know, the commercial push that we're seeing in space is one by one picking off the rationales that you can come up with for SLS. And the fairing is probably one of the last big ones. And that was fine and dandy until, you know, a couple months ago when New Glenn was announced. And that's got a 7-meter fairing. And that's the first time in I don't even know how many years that somebody announced a fairing bigger than 5 meters that they're working on today. And you're starting to see that where, you know, there's companies that are doing it for their own right. They want that big fairing for whatever they have in mind, that, you know, that's obviously a rocket built for Blue Origin's own needs, because it's technically oversized for a lot of the needs that the commercial market has today. So it's clearly, in the same way that SpaceX has always been building things, that they're building it for their own needs that they can also serve to someone else.
Yeah.
So isn't that kind of, how do you square that up with the Blue Origins of the world pushing towards bigger rockets, and SpaceX, obviously, with some ITS plans, pushing towards these monstrosities?
Yeah, and in fact, I mean, New Armstrong presumably would be even bigger.
Right.
Right. So, yeah, there's really going to be no, and of course, at the same time all this is happening, SLS continues to slip. You know, and the cost continues to increase because slips cause, you know, increased cost, because, you know, you keep paying people while well, you're not flying the rocket. So I think it's really important for Falcon Heavy to fly this year. That's going to be, you know, another nail in the coffin of the program. It'd be nice to see New Glenn fly as soon as, it'd be nice to see everything happen as soon as everybody says they want to make it happen, right?
Yeah, you know, absolutely. 2020 seems to be the year.
2020 seems to be, yeah, when everything's, we're going to have, you know, modules attached at space ISS, and we're going to have a new rocket flying. ULA is kind of behind that curve, I assume mostly because they're funding constrained. So it could be that New Glenn is flying with BE-4 before Vulcan is. And of course, I just saw an interesting, there was a piece of Space News today that to me was kind of misleading, at least in the headline, that said, you know, the loser of the engine competition will lose Air Force funds. Okay, well, I don't think Blue is getting any Air Force funds.
Right. They're a roundabout way of getting them from ULA, who put in a little money, but, you know,
right.
That's a pretty strenuous line to draw.
Yeah, because they're comparing direct funding of Aerojet Rocketdyne AR1.
And that's also an unfair comparison, because if Air Force does pull funding from AR1, or even if Air Force pulls funding from the BE-4, the BE-4 is going to continue development. You know, Blue
exactly
Origin
that.
Is building that engine regardless of what happens outside of itself.
Right, and I pointed that out. Said no, there's only it doesn't matter if ULA picks BE-4, AJR is not going to build AR1.
Right,
because it has no rocket. Nobody wants AR1.
The only two things I speculated in the past, and one of these is now invalidated by Orbital ATK pushing the stick once again, was that, you know, in the past they were looking at RD-180 for Antares. And I just guess both of these are now invalidated, because the other thing that was on the horizon is potential liquid boosters for SLS, which would have used some sort of engine in that class. And, you know, that doesn't seem to be on the horizon. And if it is, that's 15 years away. So, yeah, without that selection of Vulcan, AR-1 has nothing to do.
Yeah, and which always raises the issue, of course, that this is all sort of, the SLS is also welfare for Orbital ATK, because it's not like they're going into mass production on these five-segment boosters, you know, when you're only flying whoever knows how few times per decade. So if SLS dies, then they're kind of out of that. There is no market, which I guess is why they're kind of desperately just thinking, well, okay, let's go back to Liberty or whatever to see if we can make use of these five segment solids. But I think ultimately, you know, we're not going to be, well, Atlas aside, or maybe even Vulcan. I forget if Vulcan's going to have solid strap-ons or not.
Yeah, they are.
Yeah, but certainly, arms. You know, Falcon Heavy's not, and I can't imagine anything that Blue Origin is.
Yeah, definitely.
So
not.
I think also the days of solid rockets, at least for human spaceflight, are probably coming to an end.
Something interesting, Adam, as we're talking through this, kind of comes to mind. I was asking about the different sizes that Blue Origin's pushing the sizes of their fairings up. SpaceX is pushing the size of their spacecraft up. The difference really comes down to those two companies in particular. There's others out there as well that say, we're building this thing for our needs. It can also be used for these other things if you want them. Even extend that to the BE-4. You know, we're building this engine for our rocket. It can also be used on that one if you want it. Versus the inverse of that is the space shuttle model or even the SLS model that says, this thing can do everything. Don't you guys want to use it? And kind of that open-ended, look at how many things it could do versus built for this task, but you can certainly do these other things if you want. That
yeah.
seems to be the breakdown between these two sides.
Yeah, well, the other breakdown between these two sides is that both SLS and Shuttle. Shuttle was, it had some legitimate uses, but I mean, they've pretty much given up on that. The whole purpose of SLS, despite, you know, when they're, you can see because they're in desperate search for a mission for it, it was just to preserve the shuttle workforce. In fact, it says that right in the
it's in the legislation. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's good. Just see. It seems to me that at some point it's going to be so obviously ridiculous. So, you know, to continue that program, that it just can't survive.
What do you think is that moment, though?
it's some combination of, well, obviously, you know, if they're still working on SLS and they haven't flown it yet, or they haven't flown it with crew on it, and they say, well, the next mission is we're going to send somebody to go visit the Lunar Hilton. You know, at that point, it becomes pretty obviously ridiculous. But there have been many critiques of the program, and I don't know if just one more would make a difference, but I was just thinking about this the other week, that when you think about it, it just makes your head hurt, because it's not just crazy. It's like fractally nuts. There is no scale at which you can look at that program that it's not completely insane. I mean, you look at the taking reusable engines and throwing them away, you know, or you look at these, you know, in terms of the production rate and these five segment solids, that they're going to build how many per year, or they're going to, if they want to double the flight rate, they'd have to double the facilities, production facilities at Mushu. Then how much would that cost?
Yeah, you can see how much a dropped LOX dome is causing them panic right now in the program.
Right. Yeah, and they're welding issues. And, you know, all of that is fine as long as there is no viable competition, you know, and as long as the jobs stay in place and they keep funneling the money. And the test stands in Huntsville.
Yeah, that was a really rough look for them lately.
Yeah, we just saw the IG report that came out and said, we don't see any kind of trade study here, guys. Why did you do them in Huntsville? And everybody knows why they did them in Huntsville. But, you know, they're not allowed to say that.
That was maybe the best, most obvious example of the thing that, you know, a lot of us in the community complain about. But there's always a rationale that you can say, well, nobody's building this thing, so it's still a unique capability. Or nobody's doing this particular, you know, slap as many adjectives on this as you want. But that was such an example, you know, with some of the language used in that report, was that when we asked for this documentation, there was no documentation. And it was such a glaring example of the, you know, the Alabama-based,
right.
I don't even know what word you want to use there. But
I use mafia, but it wasn't like, well, we kind of looked through this and they didn't make a very good case. It was like, there was no case. They didn't even try to make a case. You know, if there was any documentation anybody wrote down to say, why did we do this? It was because Senator Shelby wanted it. And Mo Brooks, you know, and Russ Adelholt and everybody else. But that's basically why it's in Huntsville, is because the Alabama delegation wanted it in Huntsville.
One thing I'm curious about, I'm curious if commercial crew was flying today, if it hadn't been experiencing these year-over-year delays like it has been for the past two, I wonder how much that would change the score. Because right now you can say, well, yeah, SLS is delayed, but so is, you know, commercial crew. So is this program that person's working on. And you can do that, yeah, but that's delayed too sort of thing, which everybody loves to do from wherever they stand to the other side. But if commercial crew was up and operational and we were flying every few weeks or months to the space station with astronauts from U.S. soil, do you think that would change the balance at all?
Probably some, but not enough. Not enough. I don't think that by itself would be a tipping point. I think the tipping point, ultimately, if it doesn't happen sooner, I don't see how SLS survives. Maybe even New Glenn.
That's a big old rocket too.
If somebody's operating a big rocket, except it's affordable and it flies often, it's got a sufficiently large fairing, you know, they'll always say, well, if the fairing's not big enough, it has to be 10 meters instead of 7. But I think that's going, and then if Falcon Heavy is flying as well, and maybe if SpaceX figures out how to hammerhead it, and I don't know if they're working on that or what they are, if there are aerodynamic issues with that. And I haven't talked to them about it, but if it's just going to become abundantly obvious that there is no purpose to this program.
So let's switch topic to the National Space Council, which we keep hearing about all the time, that it's going to happen. It's heading towards the president's desk. We're just waiting on him to sign it. What do we know about it so far? Who does it look like? Scott Pace seems to be the name coming up as the head of that.
That's that's what we keep hearing. I don't know, you know, how solid that is.
Yeah. I don't want to make you too sad here, but I was born in the years in which the previous National Space Council was operating, for how short that was. So as somebody who's never lived in a world with that even happening, and you know, there's a lot of stories about how that fell apart, what would be the ultimate, you know, if this went right, what would be the purpose of it? What would its operation be? And what do you think the outcomes, you know, the best outcomes from that would be?
I'll say that on the proviso that I don't think those are likely outcomes. But I mean, what I'll do is describe the ideal.
Okay? Yeah.
Why we're doing it. But with the expectation that the ideal didn't happen with the old Space Council, and it's unlikely to happen with the new one. But the ideally, it was to kind of replace what was the old interagency group for space, which was the idea was you regularly meet with all of the government entities that are associated with both civil and military, and at the time there wasn't really any, but now it would be also commercial spaceflight. But even then, you know, the Department of Commerce had an office of space. So the Space Council was put in place to make something more of a, because the Space IAG was sort of an ad hoc kind of a thing, and they wanted to formalize it a little bit more and actually give it a, rather than just getting people together for a meeting, actually have somebody sort of in charge and sort of trying to, you know, maybe take some strategic administration direction from the vice president himself, but in terms of actually implementing that and coordinating the Pentagon and back then it was the Office of Commercial Space Transportation, which reported to the secretary, which the old maybe knew again if Bridenstine gets his way, and we'll pull it out of the FAA, which I've been advocating for ever since they put it in there. I never thought it should never have gone into the FAA. So you got that, and you got the FCC, you know, for the spectrum issues, and you've got Department of Commerce, and that Department of Commerce could become more of a player, I guess, if somebody, I doubt if Wilbur Ross is thinking about things like that, but you know, if it wanted to, it could play more of a role, particularly in terms of, you know, defining new, having, I forget what they call it these days, but it used to be the National Bureau of Standards, but now whatever became of the National Bureau of Standards, maybe it's actually a staff trying to establish some standards for the industry, though industry's starting to do that on their own, which is something else that sort of came out of the Space Tech Expo discussions. You know, what are we doing about standards? Oh, well, we've got a lot we're inheriting from shuttle and station, and they're useful, but we may be, you know, industry will be coordinating. We're going to not try to everybody reinvent the wheel. But anyway, there are all these agencies that have a dog in the space fight from a federal standpoint. So the idea is that if we have an actual space council and each agency has a representative on it, and they meet regularly, and there's some sort of top-down coordination, that maybe we can kind of get the whole federal policy establishment moving in the right direction, in the same direction. Whether it's right or not is a separate issue. The State Department would be involved, of course, too, in terms of the treaties and international relations and so on. So that's the idea, is that, you know, we have a top-down space policy that says these are our goals in space. It comes from the White House, in this case, probably from Pence, if anybody. And then the federal government is in theory coordinated below it to make sure that that happens. Okay, so that's the theory. In practice, the government is so large and so dysfunctional, and there's so many, and Congress is going to stick its oar in, as it always does. And, you know, the Space Council can say, well, we don't, you know, we should base closure, BRAC. We should do a BRAC for NASA. You know, we need to rationalize the centers. We need to decide which centers we need to keep, which centers we don't need to keep. We need to stop, you know, we need to be more strict about how we decide where engine test stands should be put. You know, so you can see immediately where the pushbacks are going to come from for stuff like that.
Same old battle lines, really.
Yeah.
It's tricky to me to envision, because even just take NASA as an example. There is such factions within NASA, the ones that really like commercial cargo and crew, the ones that really like SLS Orion. There's, you know, NASA can't even get itself together. Not that everyone in any agency should all think the same thing. That's obviously a horrible idea. But even in NASA policy, there's such battles that adding four or five other agencies into the mix just seems like total gridlock. And, you know, I'm not sure how that really shakes out in any way that's productive.
Well, it doesn't make it worse. I'm just saying it's probably not likely to work. I mean, ideally, you always want to try to coordinate federal space policy. And so the idea is, well, maybe it'll be easier if we have some, at least if we're getting together and talking about it and thrashing out the issues. But ultimately, you know, Congress is going to decide where the money goes. And a lot of people have their own parochial interests, and the agency do. And as you say, even within an agency, even within the five-sided building, even forget about the fact that, you know, it's dealing with international, it's easier to get France and Germany to get along than it is Huntsville and Houston. So you got the center rivalries, you got intra-center rivalries. I mean, if I were the astronaut office, I would just be outraged at what's going on. You know, I would have said, why are we wasting so much money on this Orion capsule? We could be flying on Dragon today. You know, and the only reason is because they think we're too precious to risk lives on, because they don't think what we're doing is important. You know, I'm sure there are probably astronauts who think that, you know, but they can't say it out loud because they have to toe the line as well.
But then there's, you know, that is so compromised by certain decisions made within, you know, for political reasons, within the SLS stack, being solid rocket boosters, an escape tower rather than a pusher. You know, that nobody else is working on an escape tower design right now, especially one that encapsulates the entire capsule.
Yeah, but if it wasn't a tractor, it wouldn't look like Apollo. Remember, we're doing Apollo again.
Exactly. That's just, that's such an obvious example, again, that, you know, between the people that are working on human spacecraft right now, you got just even between Dragon, Starliner, and New Shepard even, all of them have pushers, none of them have escape towers, and, you know, safety is the top priority, yet let's consider flying crew on the first flight of a rocket that has solids and an escape tower, not these other ones that are flying on launch vehicles that have flown plenty of times before, that don't have a single point of failure like an escape tower. There's such obvious politicized decisions going on that it sometimes, you know, it gets hard to even worry about, because the things that I find interesting are the other half of the industry that, like I said with Blue Origin, is going to do these things regardless of what happens. They have a mission, they're on a mission, and they're working towards that no matter what. Any extra help, that would be great, but, you know, without it, no big deal, we'll keep on our way.
Right. And, well, it gets back to what I said about the SLS being, and Orion too, really, practically insane. I mean, you can't look at it. It's hard to find any aspect of any of those programs that makes any sense. It's not like, well, it's kind of an okay thing, but this part doesn't make sense. No, there's no part, there's nothing about it that makes sense.
That's pretty evident in the Deep Space Gateway, whatever you want to call it, roadmap plan, you know, idea that's
right
out there.
Right.
Where they talk about, even Gerstenmaier, when he was talking about that plan initially, said, you know, when he talked about the deep stage transport, which is the ultimate 2030s heading to Mars vehicle, he starts talking up how we're doing this big vehicle in one launch because that's what we can do with SLS, disregarding the fact that he spent 20 minutes talking about what they're going to do with secondary payloads on SLS, rather than devoting SLS to a big massive payload. If you want to devote yourself to a big massive payload, do that now. Don't wait 10 years and do these other things with Deep Space Gateway before you get to that. And that's the kind of cognitive dissonance that gets really hard to see through after a while.
Yeah. And I don't envy him his job.
Definitely not. Yeah, he does such a great job, you know, all the times, but it's so obvious that he has to go out there and put the spin on it as best he can. It's always interesting, people like that, you know, John Grunsfeld has been making the rounds the last year or so, you know, after he retired, and he's finally letting his opinions come out a little bit. And I can't wait to get that from Gerstenmaier, if we ever do get that from Gerstenmaier, because I would just love to sit down and hear what he thinks about these things. Do you want to You have any interest in talking about Rocket Lab, Vector, all that, the small launch stuff?
Yeah, we should some, but, you know, that's an area that I'm not paying a lot of attention to, so I'm not sure I have much intelligence to say about it. Congratulations to them for getting into space, but not quite into orbit. It was pretty, for a first launch, it looked pretty good from what I could see. I was at the conference, and I'm not paying a lot of attention.
Yeah, they were pretty quiet about it otherwise.
I guess what I would say is that, yes, we need low-cost launch so people don't have to hitchhike. There's got to be going to be a huge, huge shakeout. You know, not all of these companies can possibly succeed. But so Rocket Lab is sort of in the lead. But, you know, Virgin Orbit, they're talking about flying this year, which surprised me.
Yeah, they tweeted a picture recently of nearly a full vessel, and I was very surprised that they had that much hardware together. You know, because that has been swallowed up under the Virgin Galactic brand for so long, but we didn't hear a lot about it. They broke it out into its own brand. They're using regular rocket engines, which is probably why they're talking about flying this year rather than the other stuff.
Yeah, right. Yeah, in fact, I just talked to Monica Jan yesterday, like one of the last things I did before I left the conference, and you know, she said, "Hey, come down, check us out in Long Beach." And I haven't been there; I've never been to the facility, so I should do that. Go see what's going on. I just think that's another, segment of the market that certainly these smaller satellites need because they don't want to have to wait, you know, for somebody else to go along. So far that's been the only way they could afford to get into orbit.
Yeah.
So that's going to come along too. And I hope we get more than one succeed. So we have some competition in that market as well. But other than that, I don't have a lot to, you know, I'm look at these individual companies very carefully and say, well, I think this one has a better chance than that one or whatever.
I find it very interesting because of how different just between Rocket Lab, Vector, and Virgin Orbit, how different their approaches are. They each have something very unique. They're all about the same size. Virgin Orbit is a little bit bigger payload-wise. But Vector's doing this whole approach where they don't actually have in-the-ground launch infrastructure. They can move it around, so they can go from East Coast to West Coast to Alaska. They even talked about sea launch at one point. You've got Rocket Lab flying with electric turbopumps, which is pretty unique. And then Virgin Orbit doing air launch, which, you know, there's been some history of it, but most of it being Pegasus, which is drastically overpriced.
Well, the other interesting thing about it is when you're speaking of Alaska is that Alaska is helping Rocket Lab even for their New Zealand launches.
Like they're tracking?
Yeah.
I did not know that. Hmm.
Yeah, they've been Alaska's been working with them. Alaska is trying to kind of unify, I don't know if that's the right word, but coordinate a lot of what's going on in the Pacific, including out of Barking Sands and maybe talking to Japan and so on, because, you know, they obviously want to get more customers for Kodiak, and because they have some unique capabilities up there, particularly for these small sat launchers. If they want to go Sun Sync, Kodiak's the best place to go from.
Yeah,
in the U.S. Is that you get significant benefit of not, you know, if you have to go retrograde, of being at higher latitude.
And you don't have to deal with things like SpaceX dealt with at Vandenberg in the early days when they had, what was it, a Titan IV out on the launch pad for like two whole months that SpaceX couldn't even get access to their pad while it was out there.
Right.
And, so there's benefits from that as well.
Yeah, because Kodiak will let you just lease your own area and facility, and you're not going to have those kinds of conflicts where the, you know, the Pentagon can shove you aside.
I'm curious about how that Georgia spaceport is going to work out. I don't really get the rationale behind it. Right, you know, I haven't spent too much time looking into it, but hearing what Alaska's trying to do and having, you know, they're up and operating, but they're having problems even getting the interest for something that is probably a more useful orbit than whatever Georgia would be, 30 degrees. It's curious to me.
Yeah, well, I'm not plugged into that, but I guess, you know, you should talk to Laura Forsick.
Yeah, I've actually talked to her about coming on and talking about it, but they're finalizing the last bits of the environmental reports, which I guess is one of the last big milestones hit for them before they can actually say that it's going to happen. Even though Vector seems to be planning to launch out of there, I don't know. everything's weird in the spaceport world.
Well,
not helped by the waffling of Spaceport America.
Right, and there are more spaceports. Again, there's going to be a shakeout there too. And then right now there's can support the are needed to support the existing traffic, and I don't know. It's going to have to grow. Industry's going to have to grow a whole lot before they can start using all these spaceports.
Yeah, and because even you've got like Wallops, which sends something to the ISS every once in a while, but it's not very useful otherwise.
Yeah, and again, that's partly congressional. I think it always got a lot of support from Mikulski.
Yep.
And we'll see if that continues or not, even though it's in Virginia, but a lot of people work there probably are Maryland people. One other topic you might find of interest, and because I just read Alex McDonald's new book. I don't know if you're familiar with it or not.
I am not.
It's called The Long Space Age. And it's, he went back, I don't know if you know who Alex is, but he's a historian and an economist at NASA. He's based out of JPL in Ames. But he went back and looked at the history of space science in the United States going back to the founding. And all through the late 18th and 19th centuries, the vast majority of observatories were privately funded. And some, if you look at some of them, they were, and this is all the way up through 1948 when Palomar first saw starlight. That was funded by the Carnegie and the Rockefeller Foundations. And the point I've been making as well is that the war and the Cold War created this anomalous situation where the government was funding this big space science, in addition to all the other stuff it was doing, the missiles and nuclear and Apollo and all that stuff. So people have kind of come to think of, if we want to send a mission to Enceladus, well, obviously that's going to be, NASA's going to have to do that. And Alex doesn't make this point, but the point he does make is that this is all about signaling. Apollo was signaling that we had better space technology than the Russians, the Soviets. In fact, there was a space race between the U.S. and Russia in the early 19th century. They had a huge telescope, and John Quincy Adams wanted to get Congress to fund one that would be bigger than theirs, and they refused to do it because they didn't think it was a federal responsibility. But some of these telescopes and equivalent dollars, he went back and did analysis that there was the equivalent of $1 billion put in by philanthropy for some of these observatories at Yerkes and Mount Wilson, and later in Palomar and Lick. These are all privately funded. So his point is that we're now that we're kind of getting launch costs down, and the Cold War has been over for 30 years. Almost 30 years, and we're kind of been running on inertia from Apollo for all these years. Well, we're getting back to a time when we're going to see private philanthropy doing space science again. And in fact, we already have. You have Yuri Milner who wants to build a starship, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So my thesis, and in fact, I just wrote a review of the book for Reason, which will be in the next issue, print issue of Reason. And I'm working on a much longer essay for the New Atlantis on the same topic, that the future of space science is not NASA, it's not government, it's probably people like, Red Dragon is a perfect example. If that's what's going to happen, if you agree NASA is doing space science, it might be hitching rides with other people, because I think NASA is going to put some instruments on Elon's 2022 Dragon mission in exchange for helping him figure out how to, all the details of how to get there, because NASA has some useful knowledge that SpaceX can draw on, but this is Elon's Mars mission.
And vice versa with the NASA partnering on supersonic retropropulsion. I think that alone, the research that they're getting out of Falcon 9 entries save NASA, I don't even want to guess at how many years collectively, not having to go through the whole process of getting a project funded to do that research, actually carrying it out. That alone is going to pay for, if you want to look at it that way, it kind of pays down some of that technical knowledge that NASA has to build up to do some sort of mission at Mars if they're going to do that in the future.
Right. And Bezos wants to have the Blue Moon.
Right. Yeah, he's been weird about that, though. You know, saying that we'll do this with government money. That's felt a little weird to me because it's so counter to what they have said most times, which was, we're going to do this. Who wants to come along for the ride? This has been a lot like, we're going to do, we would like to do this program in partnership with NASA. I don't know if that's just a lobbying ploy or if they're earnest about it. I kind of feel like it's a lobbying ploy, though.
Well, no, I think everybody would like to do things with other people's money as long as there aren't too many strings attached.
That's true.
Basically, all
I just, I don't know why you would choose that if you have the net worth that Bezos does, that he's willing to sell $1 billion of Amazon stock a year and invest it into Blue Origin. That's
well, basically, I just think he's saying, hey, NASA, we have, here's a, you want to buy services from us? We'll sell them to you.
Right.
That's how I view it.
And just don't give us any of those strings that you usually attach.
Right, right. So that was how I interpreted that. But my point is that you know, like John Morris, I'm familiar with the Bowley-Go Institute, but John Morris is setting up a new institute specifically to find philanthropists to fund space science.
It's a very interesting new era because in every way you feel this tide coming on, that there's private landers heading out to different bodies. I'm curious when we'll hear the first private space telescope that will go up, because that, you assume that has to happen at some point, right? That's obviously a much more expensive proposition than others, but in this same vein, that's a project that has to be somewhere on the horizon.
Right. And that might be one of the things that Bowley-Go would fund. Well, in fact, they tried to fund that. They had a failed Kickstarter last fall. I don't know if you remember, but there was a Kickstarter for, I think they call it Blue Planet.
That was the one that was going to directly image an exoplanet?
Yes, they wanted to build something to look at Alpha Centauri. And they had $1 million goal, and they only raised $500,000. Well, to me, that says, okay, do it again, but make $500,000 the goal.
Right.
If everybody kicked in the first time, wants to kick in again, and maybe you'll get more, and it was kind of an experiment to see how much can we raise for something. And of course, you're not going to build a telescope for that amount of money. It was more for, you know, how do we do a preliminary design?
And here it was, Boston, Project Blue is what it was.
Project Blue, yeah, that was it. And Bowley-Go was affiliated with that. They didn't necessarily encourage it because they didn't think it was going to work. But they said, hey, there's just some people up in Silicon Valley apparently wanted to try it. I said, you know, I guess nothing to lose, so try it. So it was an experiment, and they learned from it, because they learned, okay, we can raise $500,000, but we can't raise $1 million. Now, maybe a year from now, they could raise $1 million. But the fact that they could raise $500,000, I thought was pretty interesting.
And that was something that Planetary Resources even tried to do a few years ago. They had, I think they lost a piece of hardware on one of the CRS missions, I think it was. Or not CRS missions, was it? One of the Antares flight or something. They lost a piece of hardware in one of those two explosions. But they did some sort of crowdfunding to get an initial version of their telescope up that would search for asteroids for them to go out and prospect.
Right. So all this stuff is happening. And people, I think the real point is that since the Cold War, as I said, it was all about signaling. We were signaling that we were better than the Soviets. And we continue to signal that, you know, we're the leaders in space. That's why we can kind of pretend that as long as, even if we're not flying anything, as long as we have a giant rocket under construction. But at some point, you know, it's going to look kind of pathetic when we're seeing hundreds of private commercial flights a year, and there are people, and there's, you know, commercial space stations, and there probably is a commercial lunar base. It's going to be, and that's all going to happen long before they get any kind of cadence up on SLS. So. And the point McDonald made was that they were signaling in the 19th century too with all the private philanthropists. You know, Yerkes funded Yerkes Observatory because he was trying to rehabilitate his reputation from having monopolized the streetcars in Chicago.
Sounds very Bill Gates-esque.
Yeah, and so we're going to see that kind of, and we're seeing it now with, you know, not necessarily with Elon and Bezos. They're just kind of true believers in what they're doing. But Paul Allen, you know, as an example, you know, I just don't understand Stratolaunch.
Yeah, I agree with you on that.
But Oh, by the way, one thing we didn't talk about with Virgin Orbit, they have one advantage that the others don't have, and it's the same one the Strata launch has. Is not clear how important it is, but because they're air launched, they can do single orbit rendezvous. And I don't know how many of the CubeSats care about that, but it's a useful capability.
Yeah, I haven't really considered that. That's
because I think that's the reason for Strata launch. I think they want a system that can do single orbit rendezvous.
What I don't get about Strata launch is why they chose Pegasus. As I guess because everyone else had bailed out over the years. You know, they were going to work with SpaceX. They were going to work with that person.
They couldn't find anything else.
Yeah, that's between the new plane build and Pegasus. I'm not sure how that's going to compete with let's use an old 747 that we got from other company, and it's curious, but.
Yeah, I don't know. Well, you're familiar with Gary Hudson has a theory that the Strata launch is the Glomar Explorer of space.
The good thing with all of this, though, is that you can sense that it's starting to propel itself forward, and that it doesn't have to. You know, it's these things are happening because people want to, because people care enough to put their own effort and resources into, and they're not waiting to be prompted by a big government program or some other effort that springs up different companies like this. And that's
right.
You know, even I don't want to get too far off into the weeds with XS1, but I'm disappointed in that decision because it doesn't do anything to widen the industry at all. It doesn't bring in new players to develop something. It kind of just repositions things that we currently have rather than saying like, hey, Masten and X-Corp, you seem like interesting companies doing interesting things. You know, because Boeing was awarded $146 million for XS1. That's not much to Boeing, but to Masten and X-Corp, that's a huge amount of money. So I'm encouraged by seeing, you know, the companies we've talked about on this that are doing these things in the industry today. And hopefully in the next couple of years, we see everyone that you talk to at Space Tech Expo actually get hardware up and flying and operating on a commercial level, not just, you know, some sort of subsidized space on the ISS like Made in Space has today. Not that there's something wrong with that. Take that opportunity that you have there. But once we see that break out of that model of national laboratory type stuff, that is another tipping point, I think, that we should be excitedly looking forward to.
Yeah. I guess my view of XS1, and I haven't been paying a lot of attention to it, I agree with him, but it's been nice to see, you know, amassed and get that. It's almost like a consolation prize for Boeing for the X-33 decision.
It's a long time coming, though.
Yeah, only 20 years or so. And everybody who worked that proposal, I'm sure, is retired. back when it was Rockwell. But I mean, because it looks very much, I think they just kind of, you know, dusted off the old proposal and said, here it is.
That seems to be working everywhere else in the industry, to be fair.
Yeah. And so I don't hold out. I haven't talked to Jess about it in terms of what the rationale was for that. But I don't see the industry as succeeding or failing based on XS1.
Yeah, exactly.
Either. I think it's almost, you know, all the stuff that Jess has been wanting to see happen for 30 years is finally happening, and, you know, DARPA may not be directing it, but it's happening. So he's getting the technologies he wants, ultimately, anyway.
It's good stuff. All right, Rand, you can find his book over at Amazon, Safe is Not an Option. Do you want to talk about that for a minute to let everyone know who may not have read it yet?
Sure. It's basically the theme of the book is we're not killing enough people in space. That's how I always pitch it.
And I just want to mention, as somebody who's read the book, I went over it last week again. There's a reaction that people out there are going to have to that I know you love, and that's part of the thing. But if that put you off, you need to give the book a chance, because reading it, I think. Reading it in light of the EM-1 crew or uncrew decision was pretty entertaining for me, because I think that is such a pertinent example of the things that you talk about early on in the book, which was, you know, risk can be taken, but it needs to be balanced with reward. And if there's no reward, why are you taking that risk? Or conversely, if there's a ton of reward, take the risk. And
right.
I think
and I should expand on that, because that was something, you know, I've heard people say when I criticized putting crew on EM-1, they say, well, you say NASA should be taking more risk. And I say, no, it's not about whether we should be taking risk or whether we shouldn't be taking. We always, there is no not taking risk. The question is the risk balanced by the reward? You know, flying commercial crew today on Dragon 2 would be worth the risk because it would be ending our dependence on the Russians. It would be allowing us to double the amount of work being done on space station by adding a crew member. You know, because most people on ISS are just keeping ISS running. There's only we're getting about one, person year per year of actual research out of the six crew that are on station. So if you added one person, you would essentially double the productivity of the station. That's something that's worth doing. So it's worth taking the risk to end our dependence on the Russians and, you know, stop shipping money to Putin and get more productivity out of the space station. It's not worth the risk to put, and it's even more risk, it's kind of crazy to me, to put somebody up on the very first flight of a rocket that's never flown. This is even crazier than Apollo 8, because at least on Apollo 8, Saturn had flown and had a rough ride, but it had flown.
Yeah.
And now they're proposing the very, very first flight, put crew on it for no purpose except to recreate Apollo 8 half a century later. That just seems, that's a stunt. That's a political stunt in order to preserve the program.
Yeah, so I think in light of that, though, if any of you out there have not read Rand's book, head over. Amazon, the best place to buy it? Where would you like them to go for that?
Amazon's fine, but if you want, and, you know, it's available in Kindle as well. It's also available at Google Play. It's available at Barnes & Noble if you have a Nook. But to expand on what I said, the reason I say we're not killing enough people's space is because, you know, if I told you, nobody died on the highways last year. What would you think?
I would think you're lying to me. Number one.
either that, or I would think they outlawed driving. They outlawed cars. My point is, I want to be doing so much stuff in space that it's inevitable that some people are going to die. And the reason people aren't dying in space is because we aren't doing anything.
I don't think I can go out any better way than that. All right. Well, thank you so much for joining me on the show. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Okay.
So that's it for us this week. Thank you so much for listening. If you've got any thoughts on anything we talked about today, feel free to send them in to me. Anthony@managingcutoff.com is the email address where you can send your thoughts. Thank you again to all the supporters over on Patreon at patreon.com/Miko, including the 12 executive producers once again. Pat, Matt, George, Brad, Ryan, Laszlo, Jameson, Guinevere, and four others, you made this show possible. Thank you so much for your support week in and week out. And as always, head over to Twitter @WeHaveMiko to follow along with what I'm doing throughout the week, what I'm writing, what I'm thinking about, and keep up with me between shows. Thank you for listening, and I will talk to you next week.